World Watchers International originates at KLRB, Carmel, California. Here's May.
Good evening. This is May Bressel in Carmel, California. Pardon me. Tape number or broadcast number 531, February the 7th, 1982. I've received several requests through the last year to do a broadcast on Fritz Kramer. And I keep promising I'll do that. And I've been outlining articles on Fritz Kramer. And I promise within the next couple of weeks, if the news story, the other ones quiet down, I will do that. Fritz Kramer is the godfather of Henry Kissinger and Alexander Haig. And it's long overdue to do a story about him because of the influence that Alexander Haig is having in stirring up the war. He's over in Europe now trying to get the Human Rights Conference in Madrid to turn against Poland. He wants a blockade against Cuba. He wants a war in El Salvador. And Caspar Weinberger wants to arm and have munition plants in conjunction with Saudi Arabia. These people are determined to have war on every front. And because Fritz Kramer is the godfather of Kissinger and Haig, it's long overdue that we do a story. In the meantime, there's one article to start you off, you researchers who want to look it up. The Washington Post, March 2nd, 1975. It's from the New York Times, Nick Thimish. It's called The Iron Mentor, Why Even Henry Kissinger Needs Dr. Fritz Kramer. There are two points in this article I just might mention to whet your appetite. Fritz Kramer's mother lived in Nazi Germany during the war, and he went to school in England and in Switzerland and was in Italy. He had 2 degrees and then came to the United States to the Pentagon, where he handpicked Henry Kissinger to come back to Europe with him to the Battle of the Bulge and then help with the Nazification of Germany after the war. But during the war, his mother was living in Germany with Kramer's wife. She stayed in Germany. And her family is described in this particular article as being a very wealthy family. They got their money from the manufacture of paraffin and chemical dyes. Well, the only corporation that would be having chemical dyes, because of the monopoly at that time and today, is IG Farben. So that the money that Fritz Kramer had before he handpicked Henry Kissinger and Alexander Haig was coming from the chemical dyes and the paraffin of IG Farben. The second point that is always dear to my heart is the fact that during the war, his mother had an estate in Nazi Germany where she had children described as Christian and Jewish. Well, I don't believe she had Jewish children in this home, but I know that after the war, people took Jewish names and Jewish identities and were sent out to Israel, to Palestine, Israel, the United States, Hong Kong, all over the world, as having a Jewish background, and they could have come from this kind of a place that Fritz Kramer's mother had. They took Jewish names, and even Martin Bormann studied Zionism and Hebrew and understood the Palestine question and read Herzl. They knew very well the entire Palestine script, getting ready for a placement for the Jews, whoever survived after the war. So his mother had an estate where she had children, Christian and Jews, and I wonder just how many of those Jews were actually Jews but took those names. One of the researchers who listens to these broadcasts in Florida sent me a letter recently. He said, "You may remember Wolfgang Wick, a Nazi who was prospering in Israel when discovered in 1976. The Israeli government must have known about Wick. There must be Nazi money in Israel. After Eichmann, the Israeli government gave up hunting for Nazis. Jewish Nazis such as Begin have risen to power, accompanied by Arab Nazis such as Sadat and Nasser before him, who were members of the Muslim Brotherhood." As I say, there was an article in today's paper about Caspar Weinberger wanting to produce military weapons in the Arab world with Saudi Arabia. Just that's what we need, our arm factories in Saudi Arabia. There's a book review today in the San Francisco Chronicle, The Mystery of Raoul Wallenberg. Many of you have heard that name. It's called Mission Save Jews, His Fate Unknown. And soon I'll do a broadcast on Wallenberg. I believe that certain people were selected, and he fingered them as Jews, and these were people trained to have Jewish names. I believe that he was spreading Nazis around the world at the end of the war, and he's being used now as a Cold War figure. And I can't believe that more than a handful of Jews, I don't believe there were 100,000 people that can come forward and say that he helped them escape. I only see one or two families every time they mention his name. Well, Haig is traveling around the world peddling his war. And the important thing about Fritz Kramer is that he worked in the Pentagon. He started in the State Department and right with the military. As soon as the war was over, he was an advisor to the military. And the important thing is he went right to advise the chief of staffs in the Pentagon from the time of the National Security Council. He was with them when it was first formed, and he became their advisor. There was a recent Today's article from Knight News Service, also in the San Francisco Chronicle, aides bypassing Reagan on key policy decisions. In his first year in office, President Reagan has been almost totally uninvolved in foreign and defense policies. The president has not been in the administration's decision-making loop and has often not been allowed by his own White House staff to make decisions in these areas. The lack of involvement by Reagan is a primary reason why they shuffled around the national security machinery. It is one of the key factors in why Richard Allen had resigned last month. William Clark's mandate is to involve the president in foreign policy. Up till now, Mr. Meese or Alexander Haig or Caspar Weinberger have made the decisions. Meese has at times been quite candid about the president's lack of involvement in national security issues. Last December, he told an interviewer that the administration, at the Pentagon's suggestion, changed its nuclear strategy from a mutually assured destruction to one of assured survivability. They are relying on high technical advice without telling the President of the United States, and they are considering nuclear war. Now, this article tells about Haig and Caspar Weinberger making these decisions, and now they've decided they would bring Reagan face-to-face with his cabinet officials so that the important matter of State Department war, Cuba, El Salvador, human rights, torture, whatever is going on in the world, is not made by the President of the United States. It's made by outside officials, but I've never seen such a blatant article as this one going into that matter. Now, there are two articles this week that are dear to my heart, and I'm not going to dwell on them this evening. I'm going to get back to them later, but I just want to mention what they are, because one is out of Newsday. 76 people were indicted in Italy in a drug case. This has to do with Sicily, the mafia, and narcotics coming to the United States out of Sicily alone, $560 million a year. There's $1 million a day drug habit in Manhattan alone. But among those named in this suit for being involved in the Sicilian mafia drug operation are John Gambino from the United States, the notorious Gambino family of the mafia, and financier Michelle Sindona. Now, Sindona was the treasurer of the Vatican. He was the one that went to Pope Paul VI that took the investments of the Vatican property and put them into multinational corporations such as Pan Am, General Motors, Gulf Oil, built the Watergate Hotel. He put the Vatican money into American corporations and mixed it with organized crime and the crime syndicate. Sindona is now in jail for a $45 million swindle of the Franklin National Bank. He's also been charged in Italy for a murder when he was over there on his fake kidnapping charge in between his sentencing for the bank swindle here. And now Sindona is named with his links to the mafia and organized crime. And as you know, I've done many, many weeks on the links of Sindona, the Vatican, and the crime figures. But another article along those lines that I got, this is another story from the New York Times this week. Ex-Treasury chief is sued. Now, this is another branch off the same tree of the Vatican, of the crime syndicate. This says the Italian government filed suit yesterday in federal court in New York against former Treasury Secretary David Kennedy. David Kennedy was the Secretary of our Treasury under Richard Nixon's administration, and you know how clean that was. Kennedy has been charged with defrauding and bankrupting an Italian bank once owned by financier Michael Sindona. He helped defraud 1.6 million shares of Talcott National Corporation stock worth $27 million by illegally transferring this money around. Here is a man who worked with Michael Sindona out on a murder charge, swindling of $45 million, linked to the mafia, throwing drugs in the United States. And separately, David Kennedy, former Secretary of the Treasury under Crook Nixon, is being involved in another swindle of his own that is could almost match Watergate at $27 million. But the payoff is in the New York Times. It says a spokesman for Mr. Kennedy of Holiday, Utah, said he was out of the state and not available for comment. He is currently representative of the first presidency of the Mormon Church. Michael Sindona is linked to the Masons and the Grand Mason scandal, Licio Gelli undermining the Italian government with money going to fascists in Argentina and South America. So these two articles I'll go into at great length next week in much, much more detail, but I do want to tell you they're priceless because they just came out this week, and they fit in with items that I've been alleging on this program for many years. And one more quick item I want to get to, or two more, before I get into the rest of the evening. It's going to be on Air Florida, the part three of the discussion on Air Florida. Wall Street Journal has an article, Rising Media Mogul. His name is Holmes A. Court, a small A Court, Holmes A. Court. He's from Sydney, Australia. He buys theaters and plays and owns 51% of the independent television in Great Britain, film studios, film library, and he's very active in South Africa. He was born in South Africa. He attended a private school in Natal. He moved to New Zealand, and he shuns publicity. He's a very wealthy man, Mr. Holmes A. Court, and this is the man who bought the rights to the music of Paul McCartney and the late John Lennon. Maybe you've read recently that Yoko Ono and Paul have been trying to buy back the rights to their songs that were sold. Well, they belong to this mysterious, wealthy man from South Africa and New Zealand who owns the rights to the Beatles songs. So if ever they close off or don't want that music out anymore, they can pull the songs off and tide them up forever. It's sort of like 1984. They're in the possession of Mr. Holmes A. Court. I never knew his name before, but he was written up in Wall Street Journal in a lot of detail, a large article this last week. Now, I did part one and two of the Air Florida flight, and I just want to summarize the past 2 weeks, my suspicions of this conspiracy of this flight going down. It's the first crash Air Florida has ever had, and I'll give you the summary on those, and then I'm going into an analysis of the super convoluted intrigues involved in this, and this will require you to take a pencil and write down some names. They may be new to you now and the intrigue, but I think it'll be interesting to you. And I want you to, I'm not going to rush through this one. I'm going to go slow because I want you to absorb the possibilities of intrigue or conspiracy when people want to affect a certain airline or take control of another airline. There are many reasons for sabotaging the plane, and I'm going into some convoluted politics of this particular Air Florida, as I say, part three. In the last 2 weeks, I talked about possible motives for sabotaging the plane because it seemed evidence it was sabotage. The price war, it's the one successful airline going in the country with no debts. They ran an operation where they had reduced fares and they were filled all the time, as against Pan American Airlines, which is losing millions of dollars, and they pulled away Edward Acker in September from Air Florida to go work for Pan Am. There was a secret witness at the crash, always these secret witnesses with information about the wheels who doesn't appear later, but who sees it, that mysterious priest who's been written up since from the federal penitentiary who frequently attends disasters, who is at the Marriott Hotel. The filming of the crash exactly as it is done. Usually these haphazard accidents aren't documented with the filming so accurately. The ordering of silence, of identification of people that were drowning or even the survivors, ordering the police and telling them not to get the names of certain persons. The questionable passenger list, the seven employees from Fairchild. And Fairchild was it's a large corporation, of course, aerospace. But Mr. Petrie Loomis, who worked with Edwin Wilson and Frank Turple, used Fairchild as his cover for espionage work in Indonesia when he worked for the Nguyen Bank. So Fairchild is a very controversial firm with witnesses from the CIA who worked with Edwin Wilson, Frank Turple. and then the conflict of the Army and the Marines with the Rapid Deployment and Readiness Command Force. There were seven of those people on this plane. The George Bush CIA connections to Jose Tirado, recently from Madrid, who was working at Bush's home. The mock plane crash that was simulated exactly 6 months before. The delay in getting assistance. The TV filming, allowing the TV cameras there before the rescue people were allowed in. The secrets about the flight recorder that they said we would never learn about. The way the media was covering the story, making the ICE the sole responsibility of the crash without properly getting the information from the recorder and so forth. The strange autopsies on the 74 people and the competition of these various government agencies. There were so many military and government people there. Well, in the last 2 weeks, I talked about some of the reasons and articles in the paper about the conspiracy. I'll run down a few more of those that came out since the flight recorder was examined, and some of it is still locked up. One, some of you might know, it was in the San Francisco Examiner this week, a Kennedy escapes death. Ted Kennedy was supposed to be on that flight, Ted Kennedy Jr. His mother said that the sister, Kara, drove slowly to the airport because of the ice, and he arrived late. And I did compare this crash to the one in San Diego a few weeks ago where Merv Dimely was supposed to be on that plane but drove down to California instead of taking the Sunday night plane when he was running for lieutenant governor against Mike Curb. Another article this week, the San Francisco Chronicle and the Associated Press, the crew was not worried about the ice. Flight 90 checked for ice 12 minutes before the takeoff. Then this Chronicle article goes on to say 2 seconds after the Boeing 737 lifted off. 2 seconds. That's like, well, let's see. Now this is, okay. That's 2 seconds right now that I stop. 2 seconds after that, the voice recorder picked up the sound of stick shaker. Stick shaker. Now, this is a device that warns a pilot that his plane is going to stall. 2 seconds on the runway, they got the stick shaker. And yet, 22 seconds after their climb, it plunged into the Potomac. 22 seconds. They were never higher than 337 feet before they plunged. And one of the pilots said, Larry, we're going down. And the other said, Wheaton, I know it. When I referred this article to somebody, they reminded me of Carl Oglesby's book, The Yankee and Cowboy War, that came out in 1976. And in that book, starting on page 254 and also in the appendix, he quotes the work of Sherman Skolnick, the researcher on Flight 553, and it mentions less than 12 seconds later when that Dorothy Hunt plane crash was going into Chicago at the height of the Watergate exposures when it was first coming out. The last message was United 553 executed a missed approach, come back in again, and 19 seconds later, there was a crash. There was no future communication between the tower and the men. Unaccountably, the pilot requested a missed approach clearance from Midway. He was given permission to pull up. The stick shaker, the eeriest technical oddity about the crash of 553 is the behavior of the flight crew when the stick shaker went off. The stick shaker is a no uncertain terms warning device installed in the cockpit expressly to warn the flight crew the airplane is in danger of a stall. It is operated by the air data computer. It constantly is monitored and reflects upon the plane total flight state, including their speed, engine thrust, and their configuration. The positions of all movable surfaces, the wind and tail, the tabs, flaps, spoilers, are all told to them. When a stall happens at a high altitude, planes go into a spin. If it's a low altitude, it will crash tail first. But in the super safe Boeing 737, and the B-737 is the identical plane that went into the Potomac, there is absolute infallibility. The warning system has two parts. A noisemaker in the roof of the cockpit, the alarm, and also it shakes the hand, the flight control's hand, if pilot shakes. The commercial airlines say the stick shaker warning system is heard, it will be heard, but the feeling of it immediately warns them. The fact in the case of 553, that's a Dorothy Hunt plane crash, produced no apparent reaction whatsoever. It came on 22 seconds before the crash. Now, that's exactly what happened. The stick shaker, 2 seconds after the warning of the Air Florida plane, they got the warning, and it's heard on the tapes. And 22 seconds later, the Dorothy Hunt plane crash went down, and this other plane went down in the Potomac, the same kind of plane, and the same kind of a flaw in that the pilot just went on, and only this one in Washington was closer. They didn't even hardly take off the stick shaker warning signal that was not evidently noted by the crew of 553, was not noted by the tower personnel either. And this book, The Watergate Plane Crash, the chapter, Watergate Plane Crash, the book, The Yankee and Cowboy War, goes into the identical problem that the Dorothy Hunt plane crash had, that the Florida flight had in Washington, D.C. Now, another article in the Washington Post, Tower Tapes, said, I'm looking for a 737. Air Florida got a clearance to leave, but they were told by the men in the tower, you be ready for an immediate start because another plane is preparing to land on the same runway 2.5 miles away. And they got a warning, you've got to go. So they had no chance to salt. The stick shaker, they were warned about the problem within 2 seconds out there. But they were told by the tower, you have to go. And they only had the plane 2.5 miles behind them was going to use the same space, and they had to be gone. And the same article from the Washington Post says that 61 seconds after the final message, the plane lost control and went out. And they called it at Palm 90, are you there? And although the plane's whereabouts were unknown in the tower, the controllers cleared for another plane to take off. They had no record of this one, and they told the other one to take off. So evidently, if they're waiting on the runway, the ice and so forth wasn't the big factor. 1 mile north of the airport, the plane was already in the Potomac, and 74 of the 79 were dead. 7 minutes after the Air Florida left, an unintelligible voice was on the radio saying, are you calling me? Are you calling me? And the transcripts in the tower notified the authority then later of what happened. But this tower told them, you have to leave. And they had information that the plane was in trouble, and they left anyway. Jack Anderson has a story this week, Unprepared for Disaster. The investigators are trying to determine what caused the crash. And he says, I sent out my own investigators and found out that they were totally unprepared to cope with the disaster. There were no emergency plannings of this kind of takeoff since 1977. They ignored in those plannings any plane going into the Potomac. The tower had no telephone numbers or radio frequencies for harbor police. Well, all of that is a lie. I read on the air last week that they had a mock trial of a plane crashing in the Potomac on a bridge just like this. They had the rescue boats. They practiced with platoon boats. They had participants in July of 81 from the FBI, the Washington, D.C. Fire Department, the Army Helicopter Rescue Unit, the Police Department, and the Harbor Branch of the Police. They were trained in water rescue, mass water rescue. Why does Jack Anderson say this now? Because he's trying to make out that the problems came from being not prepared. That is not true, and Jack Anderson is not telling the truth. The Washington Post had two long stories on the mock plane crash and how they practiced the exact thing before it happened. The Washington Post had another story, and it was also in the San Jose Mercury, trying to blame the pilots for the crash. Again, this is trying to make them appear suicidal and wanting to die. It says, once in the air, the transcript indicates that they fought to get the jet's noise down and stabilize it. Investigators noted the pilots could have had a strong psychological incentive for taking off. They were behind schedules and the runway was filled with planes. The tape recorder shows they were ordered to take off, and they also already had problem with the shift in the warning system. The plane was going to stall. Within 2 seconds, they had warning and didn't respond. Now, why didn't they respond? That's the area where you have to go into speculation. Were these guys programmed some way before they left Washington and got into the plane that when you take off, head for the Potomac, which is about not very many feet away, and go for the 14th Street Bridge? It seems that all the signals and warnings were telling them something was wrong, and yet they went right into this problem and didn't say anything on the tapes other than we're going in. They didn't have to get off the ground or have to go so high. So something led them to just continue. They were forced at one end to get off, and they had all the warnings on the system that come through the flight record that something was wrong immediately. And unless they were programmed to do this, and it goes back again to the book, The Control of Candy Jones, where she is told telephonically to take herself down to Paradise Island and dive into a particular place and commit suicide, leave her shoes and watch at the beach and commit suicide. The CIA has programmed people, and by telephone they pick up, they're told what to do. And it was Long John Neville who saved Candy Jones' life. And that's one reason it's so important to study the use of mind control by the CIA and Defense Department, because the only thing that makes sense out of this was that that plane went down straight towards the bridge and never had a chance, because it never had to get off at the time that it did. It had the warning within 2 seconds. One other article from the Associated Press, February the 5th, banter about ice in Air Florida cockpit. Conversations between the pilot and co-pilot reflect a confusion that the engine wasn't providing enough thrust. Alan Pettit said, "That doesn't sound right, does it? Oh, that's not right." And 12 seconds after that, the plane began to roll. One half minute later, in 30 seconds, they reached a position on the runway where they had no choice but to continue the flight. Well, who said they had no choice? I mean, they're pilots that want to live, and they have 78 people on there. Who is interpreting by the conversation that they have? One says it doesn't seem right. That's not right. And 12 seconds after that, the engine's rolling. They've already had a warning, which has come out through the sound system and to the control tower, and yet the control tower is saying, you have to leave. And so a half minute later, the aircraft reached a speed or position on the runway where the pilot had no choice, and he had to continue. Well, I don't believe he had no choice. Unless they were programmed, they didn't have to die. I believe they were programmed, and that would be the only explanation, because of so many strange witnesses on the scene, so many controversial people on the scene. And now I'm going into the complicated half of this program on Air Florida, because I think it's interesting, and it is complicated. And if you have a pencil, some of you might have a pencil handier when we take that one-minute break in about 2 minutes. Run and get a pencil if you don't have one, and maybe at the end of the half hour, I'll give you this diagram again. Start at the left-hand side of a corner and write Alaska International Airways up at the left-hand corner, and the name Neil Burt, B-E-R-G-T. And then straight down, you can stop at Seattle, Washington with a stop, and then straight down to Los Angeles to Western Airlines on your left side of the paper. And then on the right side of your paper, we're straight across, put London, and this is important city in terms of money for Mr. Burt, and then below that, Switzerland, and then below that, Libya. And just between Libya and Los Angeles, close to Libya, put Miami. Draw yourself a little map, and I'm going into interconnections of these cities and that name, Mr. Burt. Now, if there were a motive to sabotage this plane or a series of motives, what would they be? One would be to cut the cheapy air flights and reduce the costs of trying to compete. People, the major airlines were losing money. Pan Am, TWA, Western Airlines are all losing money. And stop the man who has cut the low prices in the fares, cut them off, and punish him for the price war. The other way is for the CIA to get control of passenger lists, to get a monopoly of airlines, and to interfere with Air Florida, who may not be cooperating with them. The other mode would be to knock out specific passengers at the same time, such as Dorothy Hunt on the plane crash. There were about 20 other controversial people on Flight 533 that Sherman Skolnick has documented in addition to Dorothy Hunt when that plane went down. Who would have the technology to put this plane down? Edwin Wilson and Frank Turple were good at espionage. They were selling Gaddafi the means by which to blow up or stop airplanes. They were linked. Edwin Wilson was the paymaster at the time of Bay of Pigs and worked with E. Howard Hunt and the entire CIA operation and Navy intelligence for years. It would take somebody high up in the intelligence community with the technology and know how to do this. And it would take somebody who I believe is linked and was linked or to Edwin Wilson, Frank Turple, and those characters that I've been talking about for the past 2 years on this broadcast. We'll take a one-minute break now, and I'll come back and maybe get your pencil and write down these names so you remember them. It's going to get complicated.
This concludes the first half of World Watchers International with Mae Brussel. We will return with the second half after a brief pause.